Welcome to the Dan Decker Books Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Decker. This podcast is dedicated to providing my books in full, unabridged audio format. Look for new episodes every Tuesday. Now, on with the show. Hello and welcome back to the Dan Decker Books Podcast. This week we are continuing to read Blood Games. Last week we read. I pulled out a knife and cut into the wall beside the door, ripping out a rough-edged square of sheetrock that I tossed behind me. If the wall on the other side were made of sheetrock, I would swallow a bullet. I pushed my knife through the hole and felt it scrape against metal. The radio crackled, but no words came. I had found him. He was in a panic room. And now, episode 20. I bit my lip to keep from swearing aloud as I looked at my watch. It was time to cut my losses and get out of here. How long before Reed's men showed up? 5 minutes, maybe 10. This place would soon be crawling with them. It was frustrating to be so close, but not have the time necessary to get to them. The silence stretched on while I considered my options and adjusted to my disappointment. I was so close. The door would stop my bullets. The metal my knife had scraped along the inside wall reminded me of sheet metal, something I could shoot through. The kids were probably with him, so I would not risk it. Reed had taken a foolish risk by taunting me. If it had not been for that, I would have checked this room, seen it was empty, assumed the doors were closets, and gone on my way. Maybe I would have stopped if I'd have noticed the deadbolt, but I would not have given it much time, assuming it was a locked utility closet. I bit my lip, trying to figure out if this was something he'd done on a whim, thinking I wouldn't find him so fast or if he had another angle. Probably the latter, considering how he'd been acting for the children. I ground my teeth as I wished for the briefest opportunity to shoot him. One moment with him in my sights, and this would all be over. This terrible game of his, how else could he think of it, had cost too much blood. I wasn't so far from my roots to think so much death was a trivial thing. Even I still had some limits. If not so much in what I did, but in my ways of perceiving a situation. I crossed to the radio, seeing no harm in picking it up. Now I knew. He'd sequestered himself in a place I couldn't touch him. Perhaps he had a hidden weapon he could control remotely, but I doubted it. And even if he was crazy enough to place bombs in his own home, he wasn't going to light things up while he was so close, especially not with the children watching. Not unless he had some way to blame me. And it wouldn't make sense to claim I blew myself up. "Let the children go," I said, into the radio. "It's not too late to make things right for them." The silence stretched long enough that I checked to see if I was working the radio correctly. Even if I had not, chances were good he was watching me from hidden cameras. I couldn't imagine the panic room didn't have a way to see outside. "We'll never come with you," said a voice that I guessed belonged to Benji. "You will pay for killing our parents," Margaret said, "and for all the other damage you have caused." I kept my face smooth while inwardly cursing. Reed had made me the bad guy for everything else. I should have assumed he would pin the deaths of their parents on me as well. What better way to motivate them? Give them a common enemy and make them hate me. They'll be too busy to think through things until they're in too deep. I shook my head, wondering if there was an axe or a sledgehammer I could use to break into the room. "You have been misled," I said. They would not believe me if I said Reed had killed their parents. If the truth came from me, they might never believe it. They needed to figure this out for themselves. I needed to present a calm, rational voice that spoke truth, but no more than they could handle. Or it would just fuel their anger and rush them down Reed's paths. "Tell that to Sam," Benji said. "I made a mistake in the heat of the moment," I said. "Have you ever done that?" My conscience wanted to believe what I had just said, but I knew the truth. I would shoot him again. It bothered me to lie to the children, but I was a step or two away from being a murderer, or a terrorist, or whatever the world wanted to call me. Was it that much worse to be a liar, too? I pushed Sister Bautista's face from my mind, quelling the words of admonishment that had so often been guideposts in my life. No longer. I did what had to be done because there was nobody else to do it, even if it meant playing along with Reed's terrible, bloody games. I would prove I was not afraid to get my hands dirty. "You ordered your men to shoot at me through Sam," I said. "Why did he go back to you?" I hoped enough of what I asked would ring true with the kids to make them question things. They would know he had been shot in the shoulder, but did they know how it had happened? He confessed to bombing the Diagon building. Did you know that? People were fleeing past him while he nonchalantly claimed responsibility. I decided to let the kids chew on that, placing the radio on the floor and leaving the room. I continued in the direction I had been going, knowing that the stairs to the entryway were close. I tried not to think about what would have happened if I'd come up directly instead of going the way I had. My instincts had told me to come this way, but I had ignored them. When I came to a connecting hallway that led to the entryway stairs, I slowed down. I was tempted to run back to Reed's panic room to see if I'd bluffed him out. That was when I heard voices at the entryway below. Cursing, I doubled back. Once I'd gone around the corner, I used my smartphone to watch the stairs. If a man or two came up, I'd take my chances and fight my way through. If there was any more than that, I would be forced to retreat. The seconds ticked by while I waited for the team to make their move. I kept checking over my shoulder, expecting Reed to sneak up from the rear. I had waited too long. I would be forced to do more things I would rather not. I would do what needed to be done because I was Margaret and Benji's only chance of escaping. I was just starting to think they hadn't sent a team up the stairs, when I caught a flicker of movement. A head peeked up, reminding me of how I had come up those stairs. First it was just his eyes, but the rest of the man followed. Once he was in view, he waved his hand and a team of six men swarmed past, rushing to clear the rooms on either side of the hallway. I retracted my smartphone and backed away as fast as I could, keeping my pistol in front of me. Unless I was lucky enough to shoot one in the head, I was unlikely to take them down because they wore body armor. As I retreated past the panic room, I could have sworn I heard laughing. It hadn't come from the radio, so perhaps my guess that the place was enforced with sheet metal was correct. We're going to take a break now for just a quick moment for me to talk about Monster Country Genesis, a novel that I just published. If anybody has read Monster Country Recruit, this is a novel in the same series. Something worse than death is happening in the jungle. It was supposed to be Vince Carter's last summer internship before graduation. It was supposed to be 2 months in the Amazon jungle before he began full-time work for the company Genesis. Vince is counting down the days he has left when one of his teammates is injured by a strange creature that closely resembles a dinosaur. While the rest of his team is excited about his discovery and speculating about what it could mean, both for Genesis and society as a whole, Vince worries about his injured teammate Sandy. Everything changes when Sandy kills another member of their team. It is not long before camp is overrun with zombies. Vince must face his fears as he fights these terrible monsters while grappling with other teammates about how to handle the discovery. They insist on returning with what he believes to be the zombie-causing contagion while he wants to leave it all behind in the deep jungle. If you like suspenseful zombie stories that end with a bang, this story is for you. Fans of Jurassic Park, The Walking Dead, and World War Z will enjoy this novel. That novel is available now on Amazon, and it is in Kindle Unlimited, so you can read it for free. Go to Amazon and type in Monster Country Genesis, or you can go to dandeckerbooks.com and find links to it from there. Now back to episode 20. As I retreated past the panic room, I could have sworn I heard laughing. It hadn't come from the radio, so perhaps my guess that the place was reinforced with sheet metal was correct. It almost made me turn back. If I'd had 30 minutes, maybe even 15, I could have found my way in. A growl came to my throat that I didn't let escape my lips as I passed. I was 20 feet from the spiral stairs when I heard the crackle of a radio. It probably saved my life. I had just enough time to dart through a door onto the balcony of the ballroom, yanking the door behind me, but easing it shut for the last inch. My heart thumped when the latch clicked into place. Had it been loud enough for them to hear? I kept hold of the door until I'd caught my breath. It wouldn't be long before they started opening the balcony doors, and then I was screwed. I went to the ledge, and after making sure there wasn't anybody down there, I put a leg over the railing to test my weight on a small ledge that was barely 3 inches. I needed several minutes, but I assumed I had less than 30 seconds before one of the doors opened, so I pulled myself all the way over. It was 10 feet from the bottom of the ledge to the floor, a jump I was confident I could make with little damage, but one I couldn't keep quiet. Grabbing onto the support bar of the railing while with both hands, I took one foot off the ledge and crouched, moving my hands down the support bar until my right was as close as it could be to the bottom. The scrunched up position made it difficult to breathe, but I didn't stay that way for long, shifting so I wouldn't fall. I lowered my other leg off the ledge as well. My grip was slippery, but I managed to retain my hold. Several seconds passed while I looked for any other option. In the end, I decided my only choice was to drop the last 3 feet. I wouldn't be as quiet as I preferred, but it was less risky than just hopping off from above. Holding even tighter with my left hand, I moved my right onto the ledge, thinking that releasing from 2 points of contact would increase my chances of landing on my feet. I let go as the door opened in front of me. While falling, I braced for impact by flinging out my hands. I hit with a muted thump and for a heartbeat thought I might have landed without being noticed. "He's in the ballroom," came a voice from above. "Team 2, move to apprehend." I was already at the door, pushing it open and running flat out with my pistol back in hand. Feet ran down the stairs behind me, making me move even faster. When I came to the entranceway corridor, I didn't slow as I came around the corner, coming close to toppling over. A man ran towards me and I fired 2 shots without thinking. I didn't know if both hit him but he went down. As I passed, he grabbed onto my foot and sent me flying into one of the fallen doors. I kicked him in the head from my prone position but didn't see any blood and figured his armor had protected him from my bullets. Terror filled his face. "Let me live, please, let me live." I might have done that, but while he begged, he released his rifle and went for a pistol. I fired without responding, my bullet hitting him in the top of the head. The scene was sickening, but I didn't dwell on it as I stumbled to my feet and went through the jagged remains of the doorway. The men I'd killed were where I'd left them. My head swam and I retched on the steps, emptying more food from my stomach than I thought I had in there. The carnage combined with what I had just done had overcome my resolve to not let any of this touch me. A bullet ricocheted off the brick wall of the entrance as I wiped my mouth, bits of brick hitting me in the face. Cursing, I took a shuffling step and fell down the stairs, landing on a man I'd run over with the Suburban. The dead look on his face etched into my memory as I got to my feet. "What have I become?" I questioned. The men chasing me continued to shoot even though I was out of their line of sight. I thought it odd, considering they were supposed professionals, but I didn't dwell on it. A sound intruded into my mind through all the gunfire. In my confused state of mind, it didn't immediately register. When it persisted, I realized it was the Suburban's engine. It was still running. The door was still open from when I'd got out earlier. Without thinking about what I was doing, I hopped in, slamming the door shut behind me. As I put it in gear, Reed's men came out of the building. Shivering with cold and fear, I ducked as I punched the gas and turned the wheel. I nearly vomited again when I felt a bump, thinking I had just killed somebody else. I looked up and saw I'd run into a planter. It didn't slow this heavy vehicle, and it was pushed over on my way past. Bullets sailed overhead, cracking the already mangled windshield even more. Bits of safety glass rained down on top of me. I popped up my head to ensure I was driving around the circular driveway. As I ducked, it felt as though a bullet flew overhead in the exact spot my head had been a scant moment before, but that could have just been my imagination. 5 seconds later, I looked up, and I was at the place where I'd turned back and run over the men the first time I'd pulled the stunt. It worked once before, I thought, but I couldn't stomach the idea of doing it again. Too much death. So much blood. It might have been one thing if I knew the men deserved the things I was doing to them, but I did not. Not for certain. I spun the wheel and headed towards the gate. The gunfire had died, so I looked back and saw the vegetation was keeping me hidden. I was also closing in on the road and figured they might have become concerned about the damage a stray shot might do to a passing car. They wouldn't want to explain that. With the pedal to the floor, I didn't slow a bit as I rammed through the gate. The mirror on the right side was ripped off. Metal shrapnel and debris flew in from the missing driver's side window, and I used my arm to cover my face. I slowed long enough to see the way was clear before turning onto the road and slamming my foot on the gas. That is the end of episode 20, and just like last week, we're going to read a little bit from Monkey House. This is episode 4. We had rescued Becker from an animal shelter without knowing much about his history, but the caretakers had assured us he was a mild-mannered dog. After we'd had him for several months, I'd begun to think they had undersold him. He was far less excitable than the labs my parents had when I was a kid. And while he looked a bit like a lab, it was clear there was some German Shepherd in our mud as well. I stared at Becker watching him bark. I tried to remember the last time I'd seen him do it. And I could not. Had I ever seen him bark? I found Becker far more convincing than Fuzzball. I shook my head, afraid I was being taken in, but also not wanting to risk I was wrong. Come along, are you? I'd been about to ask if you were housebroken, but it seemed rude, so I didn't bring it up. Becker, I clapped a hand against my side, pretending like I'd lost my train of thought. Come. We were almost to the door when Fuzzball jumped at a breaking branch. A cat sauntered by in the flower bed right next to our home. It stopped atop one of the railroad ties we used to contain the soil and looked at us, its tail flicking back and forth. Becker growled, but he was not looking at the cat. He had his head twisted around to look at the field. He was oblivious to the feline. When the cat hissed, Becker jumped and went into a barking frenzy. Becker gave chase as the cat disappeared behind the house. I attributed the break in his demeanor to whatever was spooking him in the cornfield. Stop, I said. Come on. The dog halted, but only reluctantly, whining after the cat until he looked back in the cornfield and renewed his barking. Get inside. I twisted the knob and pushed open the door. I felt better once it was deadbolted behind us, even though I was sure there was nothing to worry about. As I looked out the people, I noticed how close Fuzzball stood beside me. He seemed to want protection, but I was painfully aware of what I had just done and, more importantly, what my wife would think when she found out. I ground my teeth, wishing Marjorie were here to meet this creature. Chances were good she wouldn't have dealt with the odd situation as well as I. She would have chased Fuzzball away with whatever she had on hand. But after she had gotten past her initial shock, there were things she would have noticed that I had not. Come on. I clomped up the stairs with Becker on my heels. He seemed to have accepted Fuzzball, but was still growling quietly as if in protest. You coming? Fuzzball looked at me, the intelligence in his eyes unmistakable, before scampering up the stairs on all fours. I was surprised he hadn't walked up on 2 feet, but didn't see anything significant in it one way or another. I was on my own for dinner, but wasn't hungry because my stomach was tied up in knots. When I'd heard the howl, I had worried about what a wolf might do to Fuzzball, but having him inside my home was a completely different side of the equation, one I was not so sure I was happy about. Sure, Fuzzball looked harmless enough, but why had I accepted the premise of a talking animal so readily? That sort of thing just didn't happen, and I had invited it through the front door. Yes, I was going to be in serious trouble when the wife came home. I'd always told my associates that things are never as they seem, that they must doubt everything, no matter how believable. Yet I had accepted Fuzzball as what he was the moment he'd opened his mouth and said hello. I pointed to the living room. Wait here. Becker went over to his usual spot on the rug and faced the window, looking in the same direction as the cornfield. I wanted to tell Becker to keep an eye on things, but my dog had already accepted Fuzzball at my urging, so there was little he would do, unless Fuzzball did something to warrant his attention in my absence. Fuzzball looked around with a shrug. Sure thing. I went upstairs to the second floor, stopping at a window on the stairs that looked out over our neighbor's cornfield. What had caught Becker's attention? Perhaps it had just been a squirrel, or worst-case scenario, a wolf. Becker's reaction alone was hardly instructive, but I couldn't ignore how he had not noticed the cat until it had been close enough to scratch him. I didn't see anything that concerned me, but hesitated, wondering if I should really do what I was going to do. Perhaps I was overreacting. The wind rustled the old willow tree just outside the window and branches rubbed up against the house. Marjorie had been getting after me to prune the tree all summer, but I had not yet found the time. I slowly let out a breath before going up the rest of the way and into our room. I knelt beside the bed. Despite living in the country as a boy and having grown up shooting all sorts of rifles with my father, I had never taken to it in quite the same way as my brother. Even now, it had been a year since I'd last pulled out my Ruger Mini 14. I furrowed my brow when I only saw cobwebs and dust bunnies under the bed, not the case in which I stored my rifle. I was confident I'd returned it the last time I'd shot it, had Marjorie moved it without telling me. She hadn't been happy when I'd brought it home, but I'd been firm that we needed it if we were going to live in the country. She had eventually relented, or so I thought. "Or my brain is starting to go," I muttered, giving my wife the benefit of the doubt. "Wonder if that's why I have a talking bear cub in my living room." I rubbed my back as I stood, wishing I'd thought to put something between my knees and the hardwood floor. It was not so long ago that kneeling wasn't painful, but now I'd feel the consequences of my actions for several hours. As I descended the stairs, I once again looked out the window. The final light of day a moment or two away from completely disappearing. Probably better I didn't find it anyway, I thought, wondering if the animal I'd let into the house was even real. Perhaps there was a logical reason why Becker had not been as bothered about Fuzzball as he should have been. Maybe the talking bear didn't exist. Something from the cornfield caught my eye. Shapes were moving through the shoulder-high crop. They were headed directly towards my home. Okay, that's it for this week. Tune in next week for another episode of Dan Decker Books Podcast. Thank you.
That's it for this week. I hope you have enjoyed the show. Tune in next week for another installment of the Dan Decker Books Podcast. One last thing before you go. Sign up for my newsletter at dandeckerbooks.com and you will receive a free ebook copy of War of the Fathers. The text, audio, and music for this show are all copyrighted by Dan Decker. All rights reserved. This podcast is published by Xander Revolutions, LLC.